Good evening, warriors of all ages and of all branches. Welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. You know, Progressive Radio Network continues to provide you information and intelligence and background and anything needed to make your life better, to help you get medical care and understand the military and what happened to us in the military. And we're never going to stop. We're going to continue to get information, share it with you, and provide you resources necessary to get your health and make your life better. Well, you know, we've talked about it for quite a while, how bad marksmanship training is broken in the military. I mean, society has changed, culture has changed. Those of us who grew up in the rural areas and the farms grew up in the 50s, 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, into the 70s, had access to guns of all types, whether it was a rifle or a shotgun or a pistol or a revolver, and you got to use them. You went hunting and you did all kinds of things. You had marksmanship. Well, culture has changed, and we've got a whole new generation of soldiers today that didn't have that experience that we had or that our fathers had or our grandfathers had. And we've talked about this before, and Ray and I have written articles before that have been published on talking about how do we improve overall marksmanship? How do we improve the use of a weapon? Well, lo and behold, the brand new issue of Army Times came. And this is the issue that's coming up for this week. It'll be, whatever the date is. They've changed all this stuff, how they're dating and how they're sending them out. Anyhow, the lead story, front page, too many soldiers can't shoot. The Army has serious marksmanship problem. But there's a solution in sight. Ray, what's happened? I mean, when we went to war before, you got a simple rifle, whether or not you were using a, going back to the Civil War, you were using a Springfield, and then we went on to use the old rolling block, then we started getting the good old Springfield Lot 3, which is still probably one of the finest rifles ever made in history. Of course, it's based on the, you know, on the Mauser, so what can we say there? And then we got on to the M14, we graduated to M16, now we got the M4 in this whole series. Ray, what do you think happened along the way? Is it just that the culture changed and people don't use guns, or is it something else that's happened?
I think a lot of it has to do with the, where we live, and a lot of it has been coming out of urban life where children aren't around weapons a whole lot. They don't hear the boom of the rifle. They don't get out and hunt like we used to. So what it's come down to, most of them spend their lives on video games, and yeah, you can visualize some of the things like that, but you never experience it. And when they get into a world that is real weaponry, like in the military, and really your life is dependent on those weapons, that it's a whole new life for them. And so they, I'd never really fired a high-powered rifle when I was growing up until I joined the Marine Corps. I'd fired rifles, but most of them were 22s or things like that. And we did it for practice and playing around and some hunting. But you know, when you get into that world, it was part of who we were. We slept with our rifles sometimes. One of the codes in the Marine Corps was that this is my rifle, this is my friend, this is my backup, this is everything for me, and I have to take care of it and respect it. And I'm not sure if they're in that day anymore, Doug. I think they've, that right now they're going to a lot of simulated combat. They're going to video games. They're going to all kind of things, law enforcement and military. But it's not the same. You have to be around the weapons to even experience pulling the trigger, feeling the pull, feeling the impact of the rifle sometimes, hearing the bang because it's a loud noise. It's less like a small cannon. But all that, you have to be experienced in it to really be able to appreciate and become very good in that rifle.
You know, we have to use it, whether you're using the rifle or the pistol or revolver. I mean, today we've got the M16 and the M4 variations, obviously, and then, we've gotten away from the good old, 1911-45, which I still think is the best, one of the best handguns besides the standalone Peacemaker ever designed, never built, to the 9mm and the M9, and they just don't have the same characteristics, they don't have the same functioning, they don't have the same lethality. And the lethality is directly related, obviously, to the ammunition, not to the rifle itself, but to the ammunition that the rifle fires. And then you run into, have you ever shot any? Yeah. I mean, today most of these kids have never been on a farm. They've never been around a shotgun or a rifle or a pistol. And they don't have any concept or idea how to use one, how to handle one. They don't understand the basic principles of what's there. And then, hence, we get into the problem that we had recognized some time ago, and now is the lead story on Army Times.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a serious problem. But any child can learn, any adult can learn, anybody can be taught, and they can be competent. I mean, you sent me a story that has just happened, or I mean, a real news clip. Could you share that with our listeners? What has happened recently in Montana?
Yeah, the story was in Montana, and it was about an 11-year-old girl that had been a skeet champion since she was 9 years old, and her father, you know, took her to these skeet championships, and she was used to shooting shotguns, and she you know, if you're around it a lot, you feel more comfortable with it because they're scary until you really learn to control this thing, and she was very good at that. Well, it happened to be that her father was leaving the house or gone or something. I don't know where her mother was, but these two illegal aliens decided to, you know, they came to this country. They really didn't want to work a whole lot. So what they did was they figured out how to do it themselves. They did home invasion. And so while she was by herself, they busted into the front door. And they were going through the house. The young girl heard them downstairs. She ran into her father's bedroom, got a 12-gauge, put some buckshot in it. And as she was coming out of the bedroom, the bad guy was coming up the stairs. And she just dropped down on one knee like she was accustomed to, and she blasted the guy. And so he went down, and then she went after the other guy.
And we need to make sure he died on the spot immediately.
But somebody had taken a few minutes with this girl and trained her. Well, the guy was coming up the steps after her, and she shot him in the shoulder with a 12-gauge. The guy flipped him around. He ran outside, and the guy died, too, from blood loss. She was 11 years old. Now, what would have happened had she not had that gun? They would have probably taken her out, too. They found one of them had a .45 pistol that they had taken from another home invasion of where they had killed a guy and cut, you know, stabbed him to death. So these were intruders that were there armed and ready to do battle, and it just happened to be a young girl who was experienced, who had been taught all the safety parts of a shotgun, but she was well-equipped to take care of the job. And she got to live, and they didn't that day.
You know, we've had on our program, we've had John Bach and we've had Frank Wright. We're having some of the greatest, you know, police instructors, law enforcement instructors on safety and weapons use and everything as guests on this program in the past. And it's all absolutely a key thing that you have to have proper training, you have to have proper education, you have to select the proper gun, whether it's a rifle, shotgun, or a pistol, you have to select the proper ammunition. And then there's no other ways around to get the proper training and go out there and practice. And that means putting hundreds of rounds downrange into the target.
Right.
I mean, it's not something you can do with a video game because there's no such thing as reset on a real-life situation. And I think these kids, when they play these video games and with death and destruction all around them, they think, okay, well, it's okay. It didn't work out good. I'll reset the button and redo it. There ain't no reset.
No. No, that's right. I remember an instance, Doug, where a man had I think it was a terrorist, had taken the people hostage, and this one guy had grabbed the weapon from one of the terrorists, and he was going to shoot him, but the thing was on safety, and he couldn't find the safety, and the bad guy pulled out a pistol and killed the guy. You have to learn. You have to experience. I've learned through most of my life, and I'm sure you two have too, that you probably end up doing what you train yourself. If you practice a certain way, that's what you're going to do. Or you're going to go back, and you're going to go back to the way you've always done things. And so you do have to be trained. You have to get people who are proficient in what they're doing, and you have to listen to them, and you have to learn, and then you have to practice. And every once in a while, you have to go back and repractice just to be accustomed to what you're doing.
Now, one thing, and I'm looking at the story here and looking at the brand new Army Times, the picture on the front page, okay, this is the picture that goes with the caption, "Too many soldiers can't shoot." And it shows an individual holding an M4 series rifle. He's got the butt plate. It's not even fully embedded in his shoulder. He's got about half of it on the shoulder and half of it above the shoulder. Obviously, he's got his hand on the pistol group and his finger on the trigger. And then his left hand is right-handed, so he's got his right hand, right finger on the trigger. But then his left hand, instead of extended out to hold the foregrip on there, he's holding on to the magazine.
Yeah.
So his hands basically, you know, his one hand, his left hand is wrapped around, and the only thing that's maybe an inch or 2 inches separating his left hand from his right hand. Well, I mean, there's no stability in that. I mean, it's just like on a teeter-totter hinge.
Exactly.
You know, and it's all lined up. And then when I look at the main picture on page 18 of the whole story, again, the guy is sitting there, and he's got the M4 series, and he's got the rifle, and you can see it clear as a bell that butt of that rifle is only half on his shoulder. You know, and then the rest of it is up, and he's got all the gizmos, and then the sling is sitting there hanging in the wind.
Well,
I mean,
you know,
fundamentals, Doug, don't even show up in the pictures.
When you pull, especially automatic, and we only used automatic once in a great while because you waste a lot of ammunition. And one of the things we did with the M16 was instead of holding it where the rifle pulls up, through the multitude of bullets going through it, because every time it fires one, it lifts a little bit. And then the more you fire, the further it goes up. We would turn it sideways, and we'd be able to control the muzzle by your left arm extending out and being stiff. And instead of it pulling up, it would pull to your left, so you're able to control it that way. And in my book, I talked about an ambush I was involved in where the enemy soldier was only 15 feet from me. I looked at him. He looked at me. He looked at his buddy, looked back at me in this split second, and suddenly he opened full automatic on me, and it blasted me. Well, the fact of the matter was I was going backwards to sit down when this all this happened. So really in the case of that, I was going down, his rifle went up, and it ended up shooting me twice in the helmet but missed me completely. If he had that rifle aimed at my chest, it probably would have cut my head in half. But because he was not holding the control of that rifle, I mean, I truly believe God intervened that day. But it's just a fact. When you pull the trigger on an automatic rifle, it's going to go upwards with you, unless it's a .22, and it'll still do it. But I don't know how you hold one by a magazine and control the thing. I just don't know. I mean, it's never worked for me.
Well, it never has for me either. And, I mean, I've fired all the different weapons, and we've both taught them for the military, and we've been in situations. I mean, obviously, you've been in the worst of the firefights. Thank God I never got myself into a firefight, but we had to go through all the training and doing everything. Of course, I know maybe a firefight is dropping bombs out of a B-52.
Right.
That's the ultimate firefight. You know,
right.
Scuds are coming at flying at us like totem poles, but, hey, that's irrelevant,
exactly.
Right?
I've never done that, Doug. I can't even empathize with you because nobody's done that to me, but I can certainly understand what you're talking about.
You know, so anyhow, when it comes on down to it, again, whether you're training with a rifle or a handgun, you have to select, and this is what we've written, and we can include this, you know, the other papers we've written on this together before. When you're going to select it, obviously you're going to have to select the proper handgun that's going to fit your hand where you can get that and hold it properly, get your finger reached around, and you can control it. I mean, obviously, the 1911 and the Peacemaker are the two best ones they've ever made. Obviously, you know, we can hire a Model 29 as a revolver is really good. Today, they go into a whole bunch of the plastic, different weapons and all kinds of designs, and everything gets near the M9, which is basically just, you know, the Model 92F and anything else, again, Beretta. But you have to get this gun where it's going to design to hold. You have to have proper sights that you can get an accurate sight picture. But it's not just pulling a trigger. I know when we went through training, this is one thing that we've taught, and I taught it. Before you even fire a bullet, whether you're going to shoot with a rifle or a pistol, you have to understand how to get an adequate sight picture. You have to understand how to hold that rifle stable in the right position. In other words, vertically, you know, vertically and horizontally, sonically aligned, everything else, and then you pull the trigger.
Right.
I mean, one of the things that, I don't know if you ever did it, one thing we've done, and when I've taught it before, I put a pencil in the muzzle, in the bore, and okay, we're going to do everything, and now I put a piece of paper on the wall, and you can cock everything back. Okay, now let's practice pulling the trigger, and you use a blank weapon or snap caps. These are plastic bullets that fit into the rifle that allow you to function without damaging the rifle.
Right.
until you can sit there, and when you pull that trigger, that pencil mark that's on the wall stays just in a dot.
Yeah.
Because what we've seen, people will pull it up and they'll pull it to the right or pull it down to the left or they pull it any weird direction. And again, with the same thing, especially with the 1911, they're anticipating the shot. And this sucker does, 1911 does kick.
Yeah.
And they're anticipating this thing going off, so they're pulling down on it to begin with and then jerking it when it comes up. And then you'll see the pencil mark because, well, no wonder they're not hitting anything.
That's good. That's good. You know, when people think about weapons, they think about automatic. That's what I want, automatic, automatic. But, you know, in combat, you don't use automatic because you'd have to have a truckload of ammunition going with you. Assault rifles are made for assaulting things, moving forward, running forward, all these things. And you're trying to put out a lot of ammunition to keep your enemy's head down. And there's probably a sniper or somebody back there with a semi-automatic rifle that's taking shots at the guy. So you're keeping his head down, and the other guy's getting ready to pick him off. When people think about automatic rifles, Doug, they're not talking about control. They're talking about a lot of firepower. It's not the same thing. I would rather have a semi-automatic rifle in combat than I would an automatic rifle because I can do much more. And if you have a law enforcement officer run into a building with a terrorist person, and that law enforcement officer has an automatic rifle, and he's got it on automatic, he may hit the bad guy, but he's going to take five or six other people with him because those bullets are going to go through that rifle, and they're going to hit anything in their way. And whether it's a good guy, a bad guy, a 90-year-old woman, or anybody else, that bullet does not care who it hits. So I think control and experience trumps all the other stuff.
And there's not enough. I mean, here they're talking about, you know, marksmanship training. And the gist of the story is they're going to put some marksmanship instructors through a specific course to increase what they're doing. And they're talking about here, I'll just read this quote, on average, a student in the MMTC will shoot more than 3,000 rounds of 5.56 ammo and about 750 rounds of 9mm ammo.
Right.
That's what the instructors are going to go through. Now, what we do know, when you get to qualification of the average soldier, he's not firing 1,000 rounds of either type and through his entire training period. And I know for me that's just ludicrous because you can't think about this and do it. You have to go out there and have proper training, proper instruction. You have to put a lot of rounds through the thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you're going to take somebody that has not been trained or brought up in weapons and take this guy through the class with just 3,000 rounds for an M16 and 750 rounds for a handgun, and they're going to even be qualified, much less be able to teach and understand all of the problems and intricacies of teaching weapons training to a soldier. I mean, that comes from practice and doing it and knowing, okay, if I do this thing wrong, if I pull the trigger, I hold it wrong, or if I don't have the sight picture correct, where does the bullet go?
Exactly.
And I mean, this is not intuitive for anybody. Ray, you said?
When you miss your target and hitting something else, whether it's a person or something else, it creates a lot more trauma than what you would have had originally if you had done it perfectly. And so what you're trying to do is practice to the point you're not making a lot of mistakes in this thing because a mistake could cost somebody their life that is a bystander or innocent. And so really you're practicing, Doug, to make you so proficient that you can dot the I without knocking out a couple of letters in beside them, you know, and you've got to be able to do that. A lot of people need to be around certain instances occasionally of where a lot of shooting is going on because you don't want to wait until you're absolutely involved in something before you experience it. That's not the best way to do it. You will do what you always practice, and whether you do it bad or practiced it wrong, or that's what you'll go back to. And so a lot of people, when they're thrown into a bad situation and they pick up a gun, they say, I'm good to go. They're not really good to go because there's a lot of mistakes and people get hurt in those situations. So it's imperative. Prepare yourself. That's where you really learn is through preparation, being around people who know what they're doing. If you hesitate, if you get in there and you're not sure or the boom of the rifle scares you, and you hesitate, it could cost you your life and other people, too. So it's just a lot of good practical reasons to practice.
the numbers here, and again, this is after some of the new training has been in place. It says in December, so what is this, March now? Okay, in December, just 12% of the soldiers were qualifying as marksmen, as many as 34% qualified as experts, and 54% were qualified as sharpshooters.
Yeah.
There's something really wrong with that, because I don't know if I'm going to go to a war and everything. I want myself 100% qualified as experts.
Exactly.
I mean, I don't. There's no second guess here. It's sort of like taking an exam. You know, hey, maybe if you take an exam that has nothing and 70% is passing, well, this is kind of like brain surgery. You're living or you're dying on your skills. So there ain't no such thing as 70% passing rate. You have to practice and practice and practice until you become an expert. And that requires a lot of ammunition and a lot of proper training and a lot of corrective action by somebody that's very knowledgeable on how weapons operate, what happens when you don't have a proper sight picture, what happens when you pull the trigger and you don't pull the trigger straight back, or, you know, you yank it or pull it to left, right, or whichever way you have, and then how do you stand?
Right.
I mean, this is fundamental stuff, and it seems like, from, I mean, obviously the story is verifying what we said. It's broken.
Doug, there's a I saw a video one time. I think it was called Lima Company Diary, and it was about a Marine Reserve unit that was sent to Iraq and during the height of the war, and they were sent in and told, look, you're reserve, you'll have rifles, but you will probably never use them. You may hear a mortar once in a while, but don't worry about it. What they did, they sent that unit up to the front lines, and they were right there in Ramadi and Fallujah and places like that. And they went from not having to train, not really being serious about it, not really becoming that proficient, because you're a reservist, you would never probably be thrown into combat. And they threw those guys right into the dog pit. And they had to learn or die. And these guys, they took a lot of casualties of learning how to do this thing that they should have already been taught. And you never know when life is going to change sometimes. And it's a tremendous diary. It's about, and what it was, everybody that went over there had these camcorders or something with them back in the, you know, 90s or something, or 2000. And so everybody went over there. And so every time they go out on some kind of an operation or something, or mission, whatever you call it, everybody had these camcorders. And when they came back home, they put all those films together and created a movie. And it was a documentary. And it was all live footage and everything. And some of it was funny, some of it was carrying on. But a lot of it was serious combat that these guys were never really equipped to go into, and they had to learn real quick or die. And so it does teach you that life changes on a drop of a coin, and so you've got to be prepared when it does change.
Well, I think some people understand. I mean, when you're shooting a rifle and a handgun, totally separate, okay? A handgun, I mean, definitely you can get 20, 10, 15, 25 yards, maybe 50 yards, maybe 100 yards maximum, but a rifle, again, is designed, and depending upon the caliber and everything, the design of the rifle, out there for several hundred yards. But ballistics comes into really a massive, massive play when you look at ballistics on this stuff. And I'm not sure that everybody understands that, because, again, in the article they talk about myth versus reality. I mean, obviously the wind, when it's blowing to the left or the right, is going to have a horrific effect on a rifle.
It is.
On a bullet, how this trajectory, but the primary thing is just gravity. I mean, the minute that bullet leaves the muzzle of the gun, it's going to start falling to the earth at a given speed, at a given rate.
Right.
And, you know, hey, it's not going to go that far before it's going to hit the dirt. So you have to adjust that.
We do it all the time playing golf. You just don't walk out there and pick up a club and go out there and start swinging it. You have to learn what kind of club. You have to have it measured. You have to have it right for you. It has to be customized to you, because you're looking for maximum effect. It's not enough to pick up. I think 10 cup proved that. Kevin Costner was using hoes and rakes and shovels to play golf with, and it worked on TV in a movie, but I don't know if it worked on real life. And you just can't go out there and pick up a weapon and think you're John Wayne and going to go shoot everybody. It doesn't work like that. The other guy may be very proficient, and he's not going to tolerate that kind of deal. So, you know, I said one time about all these $2,000 and $3,000 weapons, and said people would say, "Aren't you going to buy all that stuff?" And I said, "No, I'll just wait for the war to start and I'll take theirs." Because I've seen men in combat that would be so overcome with fear that they would drop a weapon and run. I've never known people to drop the weapon, but I have known them to run. And it does happen even to warriors. The first time you've been in combat, when they start shooting back at you, life changes real quickly. And there's an overpowered fear. That's where your training kicks in. And you realize that if I don't get to this guy and stop him, he will never stop until we're all dead. And it's like something comes over you. And so it comes through training. It comes through preparation. And when you don't do that, they always say, when you fail to plan, you plan to fail. And so you have to have preparation in forefront of your mind for safety of your family, for safety of you, and safety of a lot of other people that you don't even know probably.
Well, when we got a rifle or a pistol, and talk about a handgun first or a pistol, some of them have adjustable sights on them, some have fixed sights. If you have fixed sights, obviously you're going to have to get out there and you're going to have to understand, how do I modify the sight picture by moving the front blade in and around in the back slot, up and down and left and right, until you can put that bullet where you want it to put it at the distance and the range you're doing. Because the minute that bullet leaves the muzzle, it's going to start falling. Well, the same thing happens with the rifle, except we're going out to a lot farther distances. And obviously one of the things they say today and everything they suggest is we're going to zero the M16 at 200 yards.
Right.
Okay, that's great. Except one thing we have to understand, what does that mean if we have an M16 zero to 200 yards, or an M4, whatever your rifle is, or a 30-06, I don't care, AK-47. What it means is for that specific individual, the way he holds that individual rifle or handgun, which must be done the same way each and every time he picks it up, that rifle or pistol beside it and for that individual, only for that individual, at the distances, as he said. So say, for example, if we pick up a rifle and I sight that rifle in for myself, personally, the way I hold it and the way I look, at 200 yards, out at 200 yards, that bullet should be put in the center of the target anywhere, say, within a 2-inch diameter.
Right.
Okay, because that's a minute of angles. I mean, what is the minute of angle? How accurate is a rifle? And if we get a rifle that's down to 1 minute of angle, it's a miracle, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a real miracle, and much less you hold it. But when you're going to get that targeted in to get that rifle capability, that means that you have to lock that in, hold the trigger right, pull the trigger right, hold the rifle correctly, have the sight aligned to put it in there. So if you sight that rifle in at 200 yards, which would be the common combat distance, which is what they recommend, when you get out to 250 yards, that bullet's going to have dropped 2.5 inches.
Right.
When you get out to 350 yards, that bullet has dropped 12.5 inches.
Right.
Well, I mean, now you have to take into place that's the distance that bullet's going to drop no matter what.
Sure.
But now you have to figure out, okay, what is the elevation from point A to point B? So if the elevation at point A is less than the point B, it's still going to drop those that 12.5 inches. But where that bullet's going to end up, whether or not you're going to be on target, is going to depend where are in relationship to the elevation of the two locations is the man shooting from and where the target is.
Right.
You know, so this is coming. You got to know your distances and everything else that come into play. And guess what? You got to anticipate. You got to estimate that, because there's fancy gizmos today, but batteries fail and the sun ain't out.
Right. Yeah, true. You know, M1s, M14s, different ones like that. They had a butt plate on the end of them for the stock, and that butt plate would flip up, and you sit the top of it on your shoulder, and that put the rifle into your shoulder, and that little. The Marine Corps used to say that God made us so we could hold a rifle on our shoulder. And the butt plate actually held it there to keep it from dropping out of your shoulder. They did away with that a long time ago, but I think it's a very good thing to do. You were telling me about that. Matter of fact, you could buy that on your rifles. You could get that to go on your rifles. And that's a very good thing because it holds it there, gives you more control But, you know, one thing when we practiced a lot, we used to have a little booklet, and we would do for different yardage, 100 yards, 50 yards. You know, 50 yards, if you got it sighted in, you can pretty much hit what you want to that distance. If somebody's behind a brick wall and you can only see 6 inches of them, you're going to have to be able to hit that 6 inches. And so what we would do, we'd practice like 100 yards, 200 yards, 300, 400, 500 yards. Well, in those distances, you had to know that how many clicks to the right or the left if the wind was blowing. You would have to write that down to get it on zero. You'd have to know how many clicks to raise the sights or drop the sights down on the rear sights, because all of those things mattered. The further you went out, the more important they were. And you had to have a record of those things, because if you're in a situation and the guy is 300 yards from you, you've got to know. You can't figure it out right then. You've got to know from a past record how many clicks to put on that front sight or on that back sight, and how much windage you might have to do it to get it on target. Because if you don't hit it, say if you're 6 inches off, you're not going to see that guy again, because he knows he's in your line of sight. And so you've got to have a record to go by. So when you go to a range, you know, it's not just practicing, because you've got to have a record. You've got to be able to write down windage, elevation, all those type of things from previous practices, so you don't have to go through the same process every time. Next time I go to a 200-yard range, I'll know that I need to raise the back sights a certain amount, or I'll drop them down a certain amount, and they'll tell me about the wind that day, or I'll see a flag blowing, and I'll be able to know, okay, I need to drop it, you know, or put it on like two clicks on the sights to bring that sights in to where I get on target. It's not like a golf club. You're hoping you did great yesterday, but today's a brand new day. You can have a record to help you, and so that's what we always did.
Well, yeah, I mean, coming back to the same thing, but again, that's for every individual. So I can't sight the rifle in for me at all the distances and then hand it to you, and you can't expect that rifle to be anywhere. It might be close, but you don't know where it'll be.
Right.
So that you can't exchange rifles, you can't exchange guns without sighting them in for each individual person. I mean, you can put it back to mechanical zero, which is how it comes out of the factory, but that just gets you into the rough ballpark. It doesn't.
Right.
It doesn't get you sighted in. And when you're talking out there a handful of yards and that bullet's going to drop 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 12, 25
yeah.
inches.
Exactly.
Or vertically, just in the distance, you're in a deep doo-doo. You mentioned, and again, goes back to the same thing, the old, 30-06 and the M14, they had the steel butt plate that flipped up. Well, those are all gone the way of the dodo bird. But what I did run across, and this is available, and I've got one, and I've already put it on, and my God, it works great. It's called a shooter's aid, and it's made by Flambeau Outdoors. I'm going to get one in the mail. I got one ready to mail to you, Ray. And I got it at Walmart for only $9, and it's got there's four parts in the whole thing. It's got a part that straps onto the buttstock, and three straps to hold it on, so two can go around the top and one come around the back end, back plate. And then there's this other part that snaps on the top of it, and then that can go over your shoulder. So you got a padded, curved thing that will sit on your shoulder.
Right.
Oh, my neurological injuries, it's kind of like, oh, my, I can hold that up. You know,
yeah.
So here we got a device that's going to be incredibly effective for individuals with physiological injuries, limiting their ability to hold up a rifle, that they can still go out and practice and have fun, so you're not losing this, you know, God-given or this essential part in your life. And, I mean, so here's another little device for $9 that's replicating what had been a common part that's no longer there that can help us achieve good marksmanship.
Yeah, people don't realize. I know in the military, in the Marine Corps, when we went to the rifle range, we spent about several days, maybe a week, just what they call strapping in. And strapping in was basically learning how to create a body that will not move when you would recoil. You would take the sling off the rifle, you'd flip it around backwards, put the back clip on the front of the rifle, and then you shorten the strap up to about 2 feet long, and then you put your arm in it. And then what you do is just twist your arm around it, hold the rifle, and then pull the stock into your other shoulder that you're going to shoot from. And you were locked into a position. When you pulled the trigger, boom, you would go with the recoil and right back to where you were. Boom, go back up. And, you know, most people have never done that. They don't understand how serious it is about not being able to control that muzzle. That muzzle is going to shoot that bullet wherever you're pointing at. And if you think you're just going to pop it, and hit your target, you're probably going to be making mistakes. And in the real life, it could cost somebody arms and limbs and life. And so you are responsible for every projectile you put out of that rifle. You say, well, I was in trouble and I didn't mean to do it. Well, that's not enough. Some grandma coming out of Walmart got hit with a bullet, you know, half a mile away from where you were shooting at. You're still responsible for that bullet, and they'll hold you accountable to it.
Yeah, I think the ballistics, any given bullet, you can go, excuse me, go and pull manufacturer publication data, get the Gun Digest or any of these different publications. Go online to the Winchester, and they've got all the different ballistic tables that you can pick up and use.
Right.
But it'll tell you, again, for any type of ammunition, any specific bullet size, sighted in at any given range, what are the ballistic curves for that bullet? Well, that is a fundamental thing that's solid, but, again, where it's all going to fly is going to depend, if we talked about, the individual sighting of the weapon and then practice. Because if you think about this, when you're doing this stuff, if you just move and pull it in just a portion of a smart thing out, the angle is going to change. So when you get to more angle out there, the farther the distance is, even pulling something out 1 or 2 degrees to the left is going to have an incredible spread of the bullet as you go farther out. Because it's, think about taking two pencils and putting them alongside each other, okay, or two fingers, and then you spread them out at an angle. And look at the distance up close, and as you get farther away, until you get out there at 200 yards, you go, oh, my, I moved only a half a degree, and holy schmoly, look how far apart I am.
You know, I remember reading a story, and this is a little bit different, but there was a tugboat captain that had run the same, he was pushing barges up and down a river for 20 years, the same plot every time, up and down the river. Well, right before he retired, he ran the ship aground, it sunk. He drowned, and some other people got messed up. Well, in the salvage, when they salvaged the tug up, part of what they were bringing up parts of the tug and doing an investigation, and they found out that compass, somebody had been cleaning the compass with a knife blade and had popped the edge of it off. And so what happened was that little bit of metal, foreign object inside that compass was throwing the compass off. The further he went, the further off course he became. He thought he was right. But it shows how things move out of the way. And he ended up running on the rocks, and they couldn't figure out why. But that's why he did it, because the further he went, the further off course he got, the same way with that bullet. You think it doesn't matter here, but it will matter later, and it could really change your life by hitting the wrong target sometimes.
Yeah, so we're coming back to the fundamentals. Then the other thing, too, when they mentioned, you know, somebody said, well, I don't have to worry about iron sights because I've got all these other gizmos. I can get a holographic sight. I can get a regular scope, of like a telescope that you put on the rifle or whatever you had, or you have a laser pointer. But none of those things are going to make any difference because you got the laser dots. Say that's, again, you know, 4 minutes of angle across. That means at 100 yards, that dot can be anywhere of 4 inches either way of the center of that target, so that dot can actually put the bullet in an 8-inch diameter. And the same thing on out, so you don't know where you're doing or where you're putting it to. And it doesn't matter, just because you can see the target real good doesn't mean, especially when you look through a telescope on a rifle, the target ain't any bigger. The image you see is bigger. I mean, and I've had people say, oh, this is so big I can't miss it, and then they shoot and they're nowhere near it. You know? And I'm sitting there going, okay, you know, it wasn't really that big that you thought it was. See, you don't have
to. I don't think I will let you shoot either.
Huh?
I said, I think I'd take my rifle from that guy anyway when he said that to me, or whoever it was, because, you know, they're the ones with the optical illusion anyway, so. If they're that simple-minded, I guess, to think that. But, yeah, I mean, people do get confused sometimes. And I've always found too, Doug, you never put all your eggs in one basket. You never depend on a scope. You need to know how that rifle operates without it, because a scope can go bad on you in just a second. It'll fog up on you at times. I know, hunting, and you won't be able to see your target. So you have to be able to have. I used to have high-rise scopes on my hunting rifles, and you could look through the scope, or you could drop down and look through the iron sights. You never had to do anything but just change your sight of view. And you always have a backup. You have to learn both of those things, and you have to become, very good with them if you're going to hit your target.
There's no doubt you can get some qualified instructors and everything, but again, I'm going back to the military training, and what it historically has been a cookbook recipe. In other words, this is what I'm going to teach, so I'm going to follow this recipe or this script, and I'll read this, and then I do this, and then I read this, and I do this.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to be a heck of a lot different than getting a qualified weapons instructor that understands how to shoot all the different guns, what happens when you have a different sight picture, how do you hold it, and everything else to play. And so it's sort of like, but then it comes on down to it, the instructor can get to the student all day long and explain things over and over and over again. But until the student fires enough weapons and fires enough rounds down target and understands how did it change when he or she did this specific action, so that they can modify it and then correct it. Because, I mean, go back through history and everything else. The good old term Kentucky windage, right?
Oh, yeah.
That meant you knew where the bullet was going to go based on the sight picture, and then you were able to adjust your sight picture to modify for wind and elevation and drop of the bullet. That don't happen overnight.
No, it doesn't. You have to be accustomed to doing that. The old boys, you take like Sergeant York, they were good old country boys that didn't have all these optics and everything. They had to learn how to do that stuff off the cuff. They would see an animal out there, and they could pretty much judge how far it was. And they put the rifle up, and they pretty much knew how much the wind was blowing. They'd take a little dirt or grass and hold it in the air and drop it, and it would blow away. And he would be able to gauge that. And then he'd think, well, I got to raise it up a little bit. And you've got to, and so they could do it by nature, but we have to have all these optics for. And you have to understand the optics. You may hit a situation where the optics don't work, and you've got to be able to rely on experience.
I think this is going to be a real critical thing because, I mean, for a soldier going to war, if you can't use your rifle or handgun correctly and hit the target that you shoot at, just spraying bullets downrange don't do a darn bit of good.
No.
I mean, just because you can put a bullet out and spray it downrange, it doesn't mean anybody's going to be there. And you consider what the average person is, what, maybe 18 inches wide?
Right.
And the head diameter is maybe 8 or 9 inches. Hey, you get out to fight 200 yards, and that ain't much.
No, no. No, it becomes very small when it gets any yardage to it. And then you took put terrain. We lived in a jungle where you couldn't, I mean, you could hide within, arm's distance, throws probably. But you had to be able to, and I don't know how I'll say this, but we were in combat. We were in a firefight one day. And I had a grenade launcher, a little M79, looked like a little shotgun, and it would fire a projectile that was equivalent to a grenade going off. And I saw an enemy soldier about 200 or so yards out. And the weapon itself was not made for a lot of range to it. And so I put the sights on the guy, and then I raised it up where I couldn't even see him, really. And I was just like shooting pool. You put a little English on it, stuff like Kentucky windage. And I popped it, boom. And the grenade itself did not hit the guy, but it hit a tree right beside his head. And it got him, too. But that was through Kentucky windage. It was a guessing game. It worked out pretty good for me and bad for him. But that doesn't work all the time. And you have to be able to adapt, improvise, and overcome. And if you think you're just going to leave it in the closet and you're going to pick it up one day and you're going to be Rambo, it's not going to work out, I promise you.
I mean, we're looking at the current training, and again, hopefully they're going to modify this, but when we look at the current weapons training and everything else, the number of rounds, that the average soldier has to qualify. 730 rounds during basic training for weapons qualification. That's for the infantry, 500 rounds for the other. And then, as you know, you get a total of maybe 60 rounds for your annual qualification.
Right.
So you're firing 40 rounds for qualification, and then maybe you have another dozen or so rounds to sight in a target in practice. I mean, this is going to be expensive. But, and I understand, in a sense, why they want to the laser guns and the laser training.
Right.
But that's not the same. There's no comparison between the two.
Well, when you go to war, I mean, you've got to have the best equipment. But you also have to have the best trained army. That army is not trained to run from the enemy. I think it was General Patton said, you don't win a war by dying for your country. You make the other guy die for his country. And so you don't do that with having a better weapon. You actually do it from better training. If your enemy is training harder than you are, you're going to be in trouble. You say, well, I got a better gun. Well, he's got a better attitude. He has better training. And you shoot him, he'll keep coming at you because he trained to do that. And so there's sometimes in life that your training will probably have to carry you into situations that you wouldn't have wanted to go, but you've got to develop that training habit. And if you don't, you'll probably hit some time or another where you won't know what to do.
The mindset.
Yeah.
Boy, I mean, the mindset today, I mean, post-traumatic stress is rampant. Moral injury is rampant. But this mindset before you go into combat, the mindset that you have during combat, the mindset that you come away with after combat, is going to be completely and totally different. It's going to be completely and totally essential for survival or growth that you have. I guess, I don't know if it's a proper mindset or a recognized mindset, or is it an established, maybe it's an established mindset.
Right. Well, you know, Doug, they said that Israel, for instance, is a warring nation. They've been at war with everybody. Everybody's been at war with them for, you know, 2,000 years, whatever it is. And I'm not, whether you're for or against, it doesn't matter. What I'm saying is, they say that Israel has a post-traumatic stress level of 1%. And you have to look at why that is. It's because they're accustomed to war. And not only that, but everybody in Israel has to go to military. It's been 2 years, if they're able, fit, and everything else. So possibly your mom, your dad, your brothers, your sisters, your aunt, your uncles have been in war before, and because it's part of lifestyle, they have very little post-traumatic stress. With us, there's a 1% that goes and 1% that defends, and they leave Disney World, and they go into a third-world country, and then they come back, and their lives are absolutely changed. It is not normal for us. It's abnormal for a man or woman to go into combat or go into a combat situation. And so it's so traumatic for us that it changes the rest of our lives, where other people go into that kind of situation, and they just blow it off and keep on moving. And I think it has a lot to do with the mindset. And I'm glad we don't have to live in a war zone, but it's an abnormal it's a normal response to an abnormal situation, and so we have to be better prepared, because if we run across it, we're going to have to deal with it, and then we're going to have to live the rest of our life. That 11-year-old girl, she was in a very traumatic situation. She was an overcomer. But if you baby that girl and you pamper that girl the rest of her life, she'll probably be dealing with this the rest of her life. But because she was better trained and better prepared for it, she's better able to move forward. And I think it comes through a lot of training, a lot of developing, a lot of getting a plan together. She never planned to do that, but it happened to her. And she was able to overcome it by, adapting to it. She had a 12-gauge shotgun with her. She loaded it with buckshot rather than pellets to shoot a clay pigeon. But she was able to adapt and improvise and then overcome. And I think that's imperative to everybody who's getting ready for that kind of thing.
Well, and the mindset, whether or not you're in combat or, at home defense, or you're a police officer or a fireman, I mean, we've had situation after situation. Both you and I had a friend in law enforcement as a chaplain, law enforcement chaplain. You've ran into it where you go into a domestic situation, next thing you know, you're the one that's getting shot by the one you want to save, you know, or getting beat up by the one you're going to save. And so you got all these situations. So, I mean, we've talked about it before, but this mindset, okay, this is what I am going to expect. This is what I have to do. Is my mind and is my heart and my soul prepared to do what is required in order to survive or to protect my loved ones?
Yeah.
That's a heck of a question. Can you pull the trigger?
Let me say this too, Doug, because what we were talking about right then was preparing yourself. And what we deal with a lot of times is moral injury because we're in situations that we didn't prepare for, really. But when you go in, when you go to law enforcement or military or defending your own family, you're preparing for combat. And part of what we have to understand is the moral injury part of that kind of thing. And I truly believe in having a relationship with God, and I pray for peace, and I pray for happiness and joy and all these things. But also there's something that we have to understand, the difference between justified homicide and unjustified homicide. And if you're defending your family, if you're defending your property, if you're defending other people, whether it's military, law enforcement, if it's a justified situation, you're going to be able to deal with that much easier than if you do randomly just hurting people, randomly destroying lives. I mean, that's a whole different situation. So just like that young girl, that was justifiable. And if you were to feel bad about it, God even provided for that in the Bible of talking about justifiable homicide, that God made an exclusion. He said, thou shalt not kill. He was talking about unjustifiable killing because he did institute law enforcement, military, all those type of things. That is the good guy trying to take care of other people against bad guys. That's the way we vision it. And when somebody goes out there and just hurts somebody, that is called unjustifiable, and then the law steps in. And so I just want to make sure everybody understands that when you do bad things, there is a conscience issue, there's a moral injury to those things. And we both know moral injury has a lot of different avenues. And but anytime you do something like that, you're going to be whacked by it, along with other things. We deal with moral injury for just like in the Gulf War, Doug, and I understand that totally. But in what we're talking about right now is weapons, and you have to make sure what you're doing is justifiable, because if not, you're going to go to jail too. You have to be in a situation where you're forced into a situation. That young girl had no choice. If she had let things happen, she would have been a victim and terrible.
Well, we already know those bad guys that attempted her had already killed during a previous home invasion.
Exactly. So nobody's going to take her to jail because that girl was justified in what she did that day. And I tell young servicemen all the time that came back from war, do not feel bad about the killing that you did with the enemy. Now, if you went back over there and you desecrated him, that you got into another situation now. But in the initial fighting and killing part, if it's justifiable, God even made provision for that because there's a certain calming down, a certain part of that, that God even makes, that will give us peace about that thing. If you let the guy go, he would have killed more. He wouldn't have stopped with you. He would have gone further. And so stopping the bad guy sometimes, you feel terrible. You hate it happened to you. But understand that God will not hold you responsible for that because it had to happen. Somebody had to stop that guy. He gave us all free will. And some people's free will, they take it out of hand and just do a lot of bad stuff. And so God instituted law enforcement and other things to stop bad guys. He said the law was not for the lawful. It was made for the lawless or the unlawful man. And, so I want to make sure people understand that. That there is a difference there. But, I pray all the time that God would keep me under his shadow and make me like a little child. And people say, I can't be holy, H-O-L-Y, but I pray in a different way. I pray God make me holy, which is W-H-O-L-L-Y, holy completely. His. And so when I do that, this extra umbrella of protection, I truly feel over my life. And God will give us enough sense sometimes. If you start into a bad situation and the back of your hair, or the hair on the back of your neck stands up, you might not want to go there. You might want to turn around and go somewhere else. The best place to be when trouble comes is somewhere else a lot of times. Don't ask for trouble. Don't put guns on your side, in your hip, everywhere, in your hip pocket, and then go look for a fight. Don't do that, because you could find out that things change rapidly in bad places. Use common sense. Just use a lot of common sense. Don't put yourself in bad situations unneedlessly, and everything will work out all right. Train hard.
You know, we look at the other thing, too, and I mean, the first B-52 mission I flew, I'm kind of like, that was neat. What did I do?
Yeah.
The second one I flew, and I was really thinking about it, oh, my God, this is what the consequences are.
Yeah.
And then I had to come to the realization this was absolutely essential to save lives. And then from the third one on, it was kind of like, hey, this
exactly.
is pretty neat, man. Let me go do this again.
Yeah.
I mean,
true.
What was it like? I mean, and I'm never, what? I mean, this is a hard question whether you want to answer or not. What was it like in solid combat when you lost so many of your unit where you had to know for sure you were killing the first time? And then the second time and the third time, and what happened? Was there a transition, something like that? Or where or what happens to the mind? I mean, this is essential for whole healing.
You know, I was raised in church, but I never really had a relationship with God. But I was taught, you know, the Ten Commandments and everything. And when I went into combat, you have to pretty much put everything on the shelf, because right now you've got to focus on your enemy. And that's what I did. And the first time I had to shoot somebody in combat, I really did an overkill. I ended up shooting. And the reason it was, Doug, I wasn't mad at the guy, and I wasn't a bad person. I was scared to death of him.
Well, we're out of time, Ray. Thank you, and God bless you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll put some basic papers up there. Go to the New Army Times, read the story about marksmanship training and suggestions to improve your life. Thank you, and God bless you, and thank you, Ray. God bless you, Ray.
Thank you, Doug. You too.